Most people aren't clear on what it is they're even looking for. Most job descriptions are so vague, right? They're open to so much interpretation. Most entrepreneurs build themselves a job.
Yeah.
And to build a company, you have to focus on the team, because the capacity of your company is dictated by the capacity of your team, what they're capable of doing. This is, by the way, the number one reason that employees aren't as successful as they should be, could be, and want to be. And the answer is...
I wanted to start today just by saying thank you for listening. When we first started this show, we had one simple goal of professionalizing this industry. But more importantly, I wanted to give all of you a bit of your life back as entrepreneurs. And I never could have imagined we would have reached this many people. We've had our ups and downs, but man, have we learned so much about what actually brings value to this industry and how we could bring the change that so many of us are working towards. So my ask for you today is simple. It's to subscribe. It's the one free thing that you can do to help drive momentum in everything that we've been working on. So if you get value from this show and you believe in what we've set out to go do, I encourage you to subscribe and be a part of helping us reach this entire industry. Thank you. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Mike Matalone, welcome to the show. Happy to have you.
Thank you, Danny. Great to be here.
Today, we will talk all things retention, I assume. It's in your book. It's what you live and breathe. And I've got lots of questions for you because...
Awesome.
I feel like retention is harder than it's ever been. And I'm actually curious, like, what is going on? Why do people job hop so much more than they have been in the last, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years? It seems like it's just, it's getting worse. Why is retention such an issue?
Opportunities. There's a lot more opportunities out there now. And with the tools, you know, that like Zoom and different AI type of things that are available just make it so easy now for people to work remotely. And that gives them a lot more options of what they want to do. COVID contributed greatly to that, right? When everybody was forced to work home, it's taught employees that they have those options. And now they're kind of demanding those options. So that's the first thing that's made it a lot more challenging.
Have you ever heard of the paradox of choice? Where it's like the more decisions we have, the less happier we are with the ones we've made. So I think there might be some element of truth to that, because I think about the job hopping and I'm like, because I personally, what have I done? I did College Pro Painters for about 8 years. I did one other career for about 3 years, and then I jumped into Breakthrough Academy for the last 10. And I'm like, consistency is probably the only reason I've made it so far at such a young age. But yet everyone else is like, nope, got a job hop. So... is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I don't know. What you tell me.
Yeah. Well, it depends, right? It depends why they're hopping, how soon they're hopping. You know, obviously if you can provide what employees are seeking, right, then they wouldn't need to hop as much. So, and the number one thing that we hear from candidates, why they're looking for a new role, is they just didn't feel there was any career growth opportunities at the company that they're at. And that's usually why they're going to hop. And then it goes back to, when are they hopping? Are they happening right away in the first 90 days? Or is it happening, you know, 6, 8, 12, 2 years, you know, down the road? So over 33% of all new hires leave in the first 33 days.
Yeah, I had a note on that, actually. And a big part of it is they're not making informed decisions, is it? Or explain why is that happening?
Yeah. Yeah. So the number one reason that they leave in the first 90 days are the I don't knows, right? They get on the job and they go, well, I didn't know I had to do this. I didn't know, you know, I wasn't going to be given these tools and resources like I had in my last job. You know, I didn't know I had to work with you or me or, you know, there's all the unknowns. And the funny thing is when I talk to hiring managers and I say, well, why weren't this person aware? They usually come back and say, well, I didn't want to scare them off.
Right. And they're just kind of
like, so you mean you'd rather go through all that work effort to onboard them only to scare them off a month or two later? Right.
It's kind of a double negative. Like, there's an element of desperation to fill the role. And so you'll do things that you probably know long term aren't the greatest ideas, but for short term, you're filling the issue. And then suddenly it becomes this thing. I've noticed that with a lot of people. I personally, when I recruit, there is a balance where it's like, how do you sell this, right? While still screening for this and do it in a way that's balanced where you're going to have somebody last long term. Because when you have production going on next week and you have, you know, I remember this. I remember I had six painters, 18 years old, three of them quit overnight. And I had a pretty big fire under my ass to go hire three more. All consequences later, I didn't really want to think about until it was too late. And yeah, anyway, net, those three positions that I rehired for constantly rotated throughout the entire year. The three I originally hired for, where I took a ton of time, they stayed with me for actually 3 years, which was interesting.
Yep.
So we will get into that. I wanted to speak about, you wrote a book called Hire, Train, Retain, and you've updated actually recently as well. I'm just curious, what did you update? Like what was worth updating?
Yeah. So the first book came out of 2019. And it was my first shot at writing. So I would say it was disjointed to, you know, in the way I structured it, right? Since then, we have fine-tuned what the XP3 talent system is, and we've created our talent mastery program. So the second version was actually written as a workshop manual, if you will. So now when we do trainings, we'll say, like, if we're teaching about how to create a great candidate experience, right? Then we have videos that are 5 to 10 minutes. Say, hey, watch this short video and then go to my book and read these pages. And then that'll give you the context. Then we jump on a workshop, you know, and where we help them to implement how to actually apply that to their day-to-day situation.
Cool.
So the second book was written more of a workbook, where the first one was just kind of concepts, if you will.
Got it. What is the XP3 talent system? What is, just so, because we're going to talk about it all day today. So what is this thing?
Yep. So what it is, it's a scientifically validated methodology to help companies build high-performing teams that drive organizational success, right? And those two pieces are critically connected together, because you got to have the systems and processes, as you know, which is what BTA provides. And you got to have people who can execute on those systems and processes. So they go hand in hand. So do you get the people first, right, to create the systems and processes, or you already have the systems and processes, and then you need good people who can execute on them?
And you've got the system. So you're kind of like a...
That would be XP. Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I found, you know, looking out there, I found tons of systems, right? You know, we have marketing systems. We have sales systems. We have production systems, financial systems. You know, when it comes to the people element, well, there are, you know, hiring systems out there, obviously. There's even training programs or systems. But what I didn't find when I was out there looking for this, Danny, was an end-to-end system that connected from the full life cycle of the employee. When you first hire them, throughout their whole career with your organization. And it's so important that the pieces connect to each other. So every step in the system should lead to the next thing. For example, when you're hiring, most people are just focused on, oh, is this the right person? And, you know, do they have the knowledge and skill and behaviors, which are all good things you got to look at. But what you should be for recognizing when you're hiring is, if I hire this person, where do I need to focus my training and development in order to get them to be a productive team member as quickly as possible? So you can start identifying training needs in your hiring process. So hence, that step leads to your next step. And then your initial onboarding training, you're going to be identifying things about the person now that you're getting to know them and work with them that are going to lead to performance management and retention strategies for that individual. So if you skip any of those steps, right, you're missing critical components to the puzzle.
It's one machine, one big idea versus three different components. So we'll get into this today. We'll talk a bit about hiring. We'll talk a bit about training. We'll talk a bit about retaining and how they all work together. I just want to comment on this too. So similar to you, when we bring in members to Breakthrough Academy, we do an audit on their financials. And, you know, the biggest thing I hear from most of them is like, look, we could probably scale our business up further, but we just can't find good people. We can find people. We can't find good people to rely on to actually scale past myself as the owner, or me and a few managers. And then I go into their financials and I look at things and I'm like, so you're spending $50,000 a year on Google AdWords to get work. And they're like, totally. And you're spending $2,000 a year on recruiting ads. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, And the biggest issue is people. And they're like, well, yeah. And I'm like, there's a fundamental shift that, and it's, to me, it's not just about the money. It's like a representation of the time, money, effort, and focus that goes into this. And to your point, there is a ton of courses out there on how to get more leads, how to sell better, how to sales and marketing is like the hottest topic ever. And it's not that it's not important. Actually, I think if anything, it is becoming more important right now as the market's shifting a little bit, but it's unbelievable to me how little resources or systems or predefined processes there are out for hiring, right? Like I stumbled on just digital ad stuff and I'm like clicking on a couple of these marketers that will help you create funnels. And now I've got like 50 of them attacking me. I can't find almost anything on recruitment.
Yeah. Well, and the other part of that too, Danny, is that even with our system, or there are some other, you know, systems out there for doing this stuff, but to your point, when you're saying, you know, the people, you know, in the companies, they don't put the emphasis on the importance of that system around people. So it's like, you wouldn't go out and build, you know, a project without having a proven method and process, you know, system that you apply to doing that, right? You figure out, you know, if you're a roofing contractor, you don't reinvent the wheel every time you do it. You know what works and you go out and do it. So why would you be any different with your people when you can have a system that helps you to just be repetitive and do the same things over and over that you know are going to work?
For me, it seems obvious, but at some level, it's a pattern. It's how our industry has operated for a very long time. For people you work with, just even your own insights, like why do you think that is? Why do you think we don't focus on this as much as we should? Why is this a missed, lost art? That what are we doing? Why are we doing this?
Mindset, right? So unfortunately, a lot of managers, I think, take the approach, you know, if it wasn't for all those damn people knocking on my door and bothering me all day, being a manager would be a great job, right? So it's like, no, that is what management is about. Well, and to that point as well, you know, in today's world, going back to your first question, what's changed? Well, nobody wants to be managed, right? But everybody's open to being coached. Mm-hmm. So the first mind shift there that people need to take is that, you know, you got to become a training and coaching organization if you really want to scale consistently and successfully. But then all your managers need to be performance coaches rather than managers, because coaches are there to help people grow and evolve and learn. And that's a mind shift that needs to take place up front.
Yeah, it's kind of like, and I remember doing this where it was like, I need to go hire people to do a job, which sounds really boring and arduous and honestly not that fun, versus I need to go scout my A team to win the championship. And now I'm like, wait a minute. Let's go get the best humans ever and let's go rock and roll and let's go see what we can build together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're speaking to?
Exactly. And in fact, one of the meetings I had this morning with one of our clients up in Canada, I was talking to a couple of their project managers and their production manager about career paths and the importance, like not just up at their level, but starting with that laborer that you're hiring, right? That $20 an hour person. If you look at them as just a $20 an hour person that I need to clean up and carry stuff around, then that's what you're going to get. But if you take a different mindset saying that, no, that is the entry level starting point, a foot in the door to work your way up. And if you have a defined career path for those laborers to grow and for every role, there should always be a next step that in that employee's mind to know what they're working towards, as opposed to just earning my hourly rate and then going home and do whatever I do.
Yeah, you're basically saying like as the owner of a business, you have to ask yourself, are you creating a bunch of jobs or are you creating a bunch of careers? And what does it take to actually create a career within your organization? Is that what you're speaking to?
Okay. Yep, exactly what it is. And if you have those career paths, you're going to find your retention is going to start going up significantly because, like I said, number one reason we hear people leave is they didn't think there was a future. So if they know there's a future and a way to get there, which is the second piece of that, then they're going to stick around and they're going to work a lot harder for you and produce a lot better.
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about the journey. Let's start with the hiring piece. Let's get into the actual like training piece and we'll get into the retaining piece. But I imagine careers is kind of like the theme that that's going to follow this all the way through. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. So yeah, let's start with, I've done so much hiring in my life. And at one point I remember hiring like 100 franchisees a year and hundreds of painters and wow. Anyway, I learned some stuff from it. The biggest thing I realized along the way was the fact that I as an employer needed to get clear on what I was even hiring for. So when it comes to role clarity, like how do we determine what these roles even are and what the right fit for these roles, like what's the process to get clear on what we're even looking for?
Right. And that I'm glad you brought that up, Danny, because that's the first problem that occurs. Most people aren't clear on what it is they're even looking for, right? Most job descriptions are so vague, right? They're open to so much interpretation. So for example, you might say in your job ad, you must be proficient in the Microsoft Office suite, right? Well, there's two problems with that statement, yet most job descriptions have that in there. Your definition of proficient versus mine and the candidates can be completely different, right? So you're basing your assessment of this person based on what you define proficient, but they're going to base it on something else. So that's the first challenge.
The second piece
with just that one too is you're asking them to be proficient in a suite, and most people don't even know what all is in that suite. There are 8 applications, but most companies only use 3. Most jobs use 1 or 2. So what do I care if you're an expert in some of the applications we don't even use?
You know, another one I see that just tears me up. It's like, must work well alone, must work well with teams. I'm like, what are you telling me? You're telling me that you're telling me nothing.
Pick one.
So how do we do this? How do we get more?
Let me add this to it too, Dave, if it helps us too, because this is, by the way, the number one reason that employees aren't as successful as they should be, could be, and want to be. And the answer is managers typically do not do a good job at defining what success is in that role, right? So take even that simple application I was talking about. Well, first off, you know, if you know they're all going to use Word and Excel and Outlook, then assess them against those 3. But don't use words like proficient. So when we're talking to the candidate or screening them, we'll say, hey, here's the 3 applications you're going to use. And by the way, this is just the example. I would also throw in every other application they use. Rank yourself as a novice, intermediate, or expert on each of these applications, right, that you will be using day to day in your job. And for any of them that you've ranked yourself as an intermediate or expert, I need you to tell me why you believe you're an expert, for example. So Microsoft Excel, right? Don't tell me you're an expert at Microsoft Excel because you've used it for 15 years. I've been using it without dating myself ever since it came out. And I'm barely an intermediate, right? If you're an expert, you can teach a class on it. You can create all formulas. You can create pivot tables, Gantt charts, right? There's pretty much nothing you can't do. And when I explain that to candidates after they rank themselves as an expert, they'll go, oh, yeah, well, I can't do any of those things. So I guess maybe I'm only an intermediate. And then you can kind of drill down and figure out what that means as well. But that's a classic example of defining success just at a basic level of an application.
Getting down to the specifics versus the overarching, yeah. Like I'm good or I'm bad. It's like, no, that's subjective. What's the objective truth is usually in the stories or the specifics of that yeah. element or that area.
The other part too is you have to decide, right, what level of expertise do you need?
So
I've never done that, Danny, but I'm smart. I can learn. Well, as the hiring manager, you got to decide, well, A, can you teach? B, do you have the time for them to learn? Because most things don't happen overnight. Sometimes it takes years to develop a skill set. So can you afford the learning curve? And that helps you to get clear on what it exactly is that you're looking for and at what level you need to come in at.
This is, I remember speaking to this years ago, which was your training program directly translates into how skilled your person that you hire needs to be. If you've got a robust in-house training process, you can go after the younger, greener human beings that are probably a little easier to find, more moldable.
Yep.
But if your training process sucks, you have to go after these more skilled, experienced people, which usually honestly come with a lot more baggage and ways of doing things that aren't your company culture way. And so it's matching that up and deciding how much time, effort, resources do we have in our training to decide how much skill is required for the baseline set of this role for the person coming in.
Yeah, that's a big piece of it. The other part of it is figuring out how soon do I need this person to be productive,
right?
And what does productive mean for that role? So let's take a project manager. I'm hiring a new project manager. And after 30 days of onboarding training, learning about our systems, processes, materials, tools, et cetera, I need you out there running jobs on your own, right? Well, if that is your requirement, right, that timeline of 30 days running jobs on your own, well, then the level of knowledge and skill that PM needs to bring to the job to start with needs to be way higher than that person you were talking about that, hey, you know what? I got 6 months before you're running jobs completely on your own, right? Well, then you can lower your expectations on the knowledge and skill of what you're looking for because you now have that time. So The point I'm making, Danny, is the time of when you need the results drives the level of knowledge and skill that the person needs to bring.
Here's another question on this. The amount of different things that a role should have in it, because I see this in smaller businesses, right? When you're at $1 million, $2 million a year, you tend to hire somebody that does three different jobs or four different jobs. And it's hard to not only find that person, but you usually don't actually find that person. And you kind of just like, you know, I call it the rose colored glasses, like just like put on the, oh, it'll be fine. We'll figure it out together. And you put, you set them up for failure because it's like, hey, you're going to be the production manager. You're also going to sell your own work. You're also going to do all the admin on the back end. It's going to be great. How do we deal with that? Especially when we're in a position where we can't hire all three of those roles. And how do we find the right people when it comes to that?
Yeah, kind of stuff? And when you're small, right, you don't have the luxury of saying, oh, that job is three different roles.
Yeah.
Right. We can't afford that right now. So we have to do it this way. Well, then it goes back to them. Decide which of those elements is the most important driver to your success. And recognize that you're probably not going to find someone who's an expert at all of them. Mm-hmm. Right. A classic one I see is in the either kitchen and bath designers, you know, where, you know, I need someone who's really good at AutoCAD and Revit and all these other design tools. But I also need them really good with the customer because they're also selling. Right. And it's like the skills that make you good as a designer are usually the exact opposite of what makes you good at sales and vice versa. So it's like, okay, you can have them do both, but which one is more important? And that's the one that you hired to.
Okay. For this process, there's personality and then there's skill. When it comes to personality, I mean, I feel like I teach this so much, it's almost common knowledge to the industry now. It's like, it is more important than skill. We know this. But how much does this impact retention and how do we get it right? Like what, how do we know what personality traits need to exist in what roles?
Right. So first off, I'll say that most people don't understand this at the level you and I do. You know, that they might go, oh yeah, we use personality assessments in our hiring or whatever, but they don't really understand what they're measuring. So the first thing is you got to understand what they measure, and the behavioral components, the personality traits really don't dictate how well I can do a job. That's your knowledge and skill, right? So understanding what is personality really telling you? Well, when done appropriately and applied appropriately, what you're really doing is finding out, is this employee going to be intrinsically motivated by the behaviors of the job, mm-hmm. right? So the knowledge and skill is the, can they do it? The behavioral personality side is, do they want to do it? Mm-hmm. Are they going to enjoy it? And in order to get someone who's consistently productive at a high level, then you got to have both, right? And in the ideal world, that's what you're looking for. But in that, go back to that example you gave with some entry-level person. Well, I'm not looking for a lot of skill because we can train. Then put a lot more emphasis on the personality and the behavior. But once there's skill requirements there, then they're equal, right? You got to look at both, but never make a decision on hiring somebody just on one of those factors alone. You need as much data as possible. So that's the first part. Second part of what you asked is, how do you do it? So you want to use an assessment tool that has a target job profiling tool component. So like, for example, I know the Predictive Index does. We use a tool called the MPO. They have it. And there's probably a half a dozen other tools out there that have those. But you go in and you select, well, what are the behavioral competencies that are required, you know, to be a project manager at your company? And this is the difference. So DISC, that I know most people are familiar with, DISC has standard profiles that they provide and say, hey, this is a good one for a salesperson. This is a good one for a PM. And they're clips. And the good thing to understand is that this is behavioral science, and behavioral science is a close, is good enough science. So that'll work if you have that target. But these other tools I mentioned actually help you to drill deeper because, you know, you may be doing the same exact thing as your competitor down the road, you know, as far as the products you sell, the services you deliver, but the way you run your company, your culture, the way you manage could be completely different. Therefore, that might change some of those behavioral attributes that you need for your project manager versus that company down the road. So pinpointing what you need is the starting point and having a benchmark to measure against.
You're bringing up a third thing that I feel like is just separate. So it's kind of like personality, skill, and then there's like core values or culture fit. Is that its own thing?
The cultural fit?
Yeah. Like, I'm just thinking about, like, if you've got the personality to have a tenacity to work outside all day and hard work is like tenacity's definition, or attainment, you like to set and hit goals. These are like personality preferences that lead you to be a good, you know, worker in the field, or attainment might lead you to be a good salesperson because you like to set and hit goals. But then there's culture fit, which is like your values and what you care about. Is that a third thing, or is that just a part of the personality profiling?
Well, the person has, it's sort of separate, but there is a connection to it. So let me think for a sec how I want to put this in a concise way. When you're looking at culture, right, which as you kind of just pointed to, your culture is really your mission, vision, and values, how you guys operate, right? That kind of helps define your base culture. That's as equally as important to hire to as the knowledge and skill. Sometimes more important, right? If, like we said, if you're not looking for as much knowledge and skill, then that cultural fit is the predominant thing you're looking at. So the other side of that, right? You can have all the knowledge and skill in the world, but if you ain't a cultural fit, you know, we were talking about retention. It's not if, it's when it's not going to work out, yeah. Right? So you need to focus on that right up front being equally as important, if not more important, to make sure they're a fit with your culture. Now, that coming back to the personality profile, you know, there's all different types of personalities. In fact, we know in the behavioral science world, there's really about 18 typical behavioral profiles that most us human beings fall into. There's a few outliers, but most of us fall into those, which means, you know, that there are differences, 18 different styles and differences. And by the way, for people that aren't aware, behavior is defined as how you're wired to think, how you feel about what you think about. That combination predicts how you will behave in most situations, right?
It's your lens in which you see the world through.
Right. But culture is like, you know, things like, go back to your core values, integrity, honesty, teamwork, right? Mm-hmm. There are hints in a personality profile that will give you some insight, but most of the cultural stuff comes from how you were raised, how you were mentored, what personal values do you have, right? And those could be completely different or beyond your personality traits, how you're wired to think, feel, and behave. So where you use the personalities effectively is, and the example I like to give is attention to detail. Are you good attention to detail kind of guy?
No. Sorry.
Me neither. That's right. I'm right there. But I guarantee, Danny, that you're excellent at details in your job where it's important. But what you probably just told me is you don't enjoy doing details. No. And as long as you only got to do it maybe a short period of time in your work, no big deal. You suck it up, you get it done, right?
Correct.
And yep. That's how I am. That's how most entrepreneurs are. But take a project manager, right? 70-80% of the tasks that a PM does is all about attention to detail, right? Now, you and I could learn how to be a great PM and do it effectively as anybody. But if we don't enjoy doing the detail work, we're not going to be consistent. We're not going to look forward to coming to work every day, right? Because it's like, oh God, I got to do these details again, right? So if you want somebody consistently productive and what we call highly engaged, then you want to make sure they not only have the knowledge and skill to know how to do those details, but then they are naturally wired to enjoy doing detail work. And that ends up tapping into something called discretionary effort that we can talk about later.
Okay. So I just want to sum this up. Skill is important to the amount of training and time in that training you're willing to commit to as a company. Personality is important for the role and the type of tasks, so they enjoy doing those things intrinsically. And then we kind of touched on core values and culture, but that is like a fit or not a fit based on how you define your culture. I have a question about this because I've been interviewing people since I was 18 years old, and I still struggle a little bit to objectively find core values in people, to know that those are true core values. I have my own thoughts on how I do this. I'd be curious to know, how do you interview somebody on their core values to make sure you're getting the right answers and not getting just yeses from them or bullshit from them because they want to tell you that they, you know what I mean? How do you get there?
Yeah. So first, you know, you have to have a defined culture.
Sure. Yeah.
And understanding what that means. So like when we take on a new client, one of the first questions I ask you, describe your culture to me. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you've asked this question in your work you do. And as you know, most people have a hard time describing it, right? Or the one you hear a lot in construction, like you know, particularly home improvement, is we're a family culture.
I was right? like, what does that mean?
Yeah. What's that mean? But for me, that kind of scares me, right? Because I know for a fact that most families are highly dysfunctional.
Right.
And have lots of dysfunction going on, right? But when you tell me, hey, we're a team-oriented culture, that's very different. You know, high-functioning teams have very little dysfunction, if any, right? So, but go back to the beginning. It's like most people just can't even define it. So you have to understand can you describe what your culture is in order to be able to recognize if someone has it, right? And again, it'll go back to your core values is the biggest part. So during the interview process, you know, we ask people, hey, you know, what do you know about our company? Did you go to our website? By the way, for all your listeners, if you don't have your mission, vision, and values on your website, then that's the first thing you need to do right now is go put them on there. Second piece, or maybe in preface of that, make sure they're well defined and structured appropriately, because that's the thing too. Some people have way too many. They're too hard to memorize, get your hand around. And even taking the word like integrity, right? A lot of companies have that as one of their core values, but what integrity might mean to you at VTA could be different than what it means to me here at XP3, right? So I need to know, what does integrity mean? Can you give me some examples? Now, once I hear that, right, now I can ask the candidate questions around integrity and find out if they're in sync with what your meaning is and if that will match up.
I'll tell you what I have experimented with, and it works-ish, is I don't just look at where they've exemplified those core values in their life, but I look at where they've been challenged and how they reacted. And I'm less worried about, I'm less worried about where they've like exemplified all the good scenarios. I'm like, where have you been super challenged to actually like be the natural state of you? Because one of our values is be real. And so I'm like, you know, in what scenarios have you felt the most awkward, the most out of place, where you had to put on a mask? How did you deal with that? How did that impact you? What did you think about that? What did you learn from that? And I want to see what their reaction is to it. And if you can tell, they're like, it was so not me. It was so, like, and they're getting into more of the detail around wanting to shift that, or they found a way to shift that. It's cool. If they're like, oh no, like it's fine. Like if I need to, like in a sales environment, just like put on a mask, I can do it. I'm pretty good at it actually. I'd be like, hey, your core value is probably not be real, because you didn't struggle through that. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, more specifically, I would ask the candidate, like using the word integrity, I'd say, can you give me an example of when your integrity was challenged? Mm-hmm. You know, what was the situation? Why was that a problem for you? And how did you work through it?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And then you can start hear how they describe what integrity means to them. Right? Does it match? And even another one, just giving an example on that too, like one of the questions I like to ask for most roles is, you know, and depending on the role, name the role, if you're a PM, tell me the most challenging project management situation you've ever had to deal with.
Right.
If you're a sales rep, tell me the most challenging sales you ever dealt with, right? Marketing, finance, whatever it is, fill in the blank. And then listen to what they tell you of what, and remember, you got to say the most challenging thing you ever had to deal with. And compare that to what you know they're going to have to deal with in the role at your company, right? So classic one, interviewing. It was one of our larger clients. I was with the VP of HR. We were hiring an HR generalist, right? So we said, tell us the most challenging HR employee relation issue you ever had to deal with, right? And she goes, oh, yeah, that's easy. 3 years ago, this employee kept dropping the F-bomb, right? And she made this big, big deal out of that. So as soon as the interview was over, she walked out. The VP of HR looks at me and she goes, no effing way she's going to work here. Because we're a construction company. That, unfortunately, that's how people talk. And if that impacted her to that level, she's not up to this.
Past performance predicts future results. And I have experimented with this for so long. And I went against this rule even once because I was, again, desperate to hire. And I've realized people will repeat themselves in patterns over and over and over again. And I can wish and coach and be the best supporter ever to try and get them through this. I remember I made a few exceptions, and it was actually specifically around the trait of ability to handle stress in pursuit of a goal. And I'm bringing in these franchisees, and I know that you're going to go through extremely stressful stuff trying to figure out how to run a business. It's not easy. And I gave into a couple of them where like, I will teach you how to handle stress in pursuit of a goal. And every single one of them failed except one. And it was really interesting. You know why the one actually did okay? They personally dug deep and made their own efforts and endeavors to work through that side of who they were. The other ones said they would want to, but I was like one of these things where you're pulling a horse to water. It's like I was the one pulling them through it, and they really weren't actually mentally committed. And what I realized is like I can't afford to base what somebody else says they would do or could do if given a chance on my company's success. And even though that one person worked out, it was too much of a gamble for the other three or four that didn't. And I now need to be objective to listen for what has happened versus what you think you would do in a hypothetical scenario. And once I hear what's happened, all I can go off of is that. And that is now truth. And there's probably a 95% likelihood that you will do exactly that same thing in my company. So change the name, change the owner name, change the company name, change the scenario. And I've seen it literally 3 months later on my sites, exact same stuff. And I'm like, all right, I give, I will stop trying to control reality. What I hear from you and your past stories will predict future results, period, the end.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got into hiring a lot. Let's move into training. So We've looked into this person. We've gone through their personality profile. We've gotten to make sure they're the right fit for the role. We've looked at their skill sets and does it match what we're willing to train? Now let's talk about training. So what are the objectives in your training and onboarding process? What should you be looking to do?
Yep. So first, let me tell you what not to do.
Sure.
As a priority, train them for the job you hired them on. I'm not saying don't train them for the job, but that is not your priority. So there are three objectives, as you pointed out, that we follow with our onboarding training. And for clarity for the audience, when we talk about onboarding training, we're not talking about filling out, you know, the HR paperwork, right? Get signed up for your benefits. We're talking about how do you train them to be a productive and what we like to call a productive, collaborative, passionate company advocate, right? Ultimately, that is your objective, to create passionate, collaborative, productive company advocates. So the way you accomplish that is, number one, think about you only have one chance to make a good first impression with people. So you need to focus on creating an amazing experience for that new employee. The first day is the most important, but that first week is equally as important. But if you wait beyond that first day to start doing stuff, it's too late, right? And by the way, what we're trying to do is create a psychological connection between that new hire and your company. And there are two pieces. One, to your culture, your mission, vision, values, as we discussed, right? So that's why I said you're going to interview around stuff we just talked about to find out if they're a cultural fit. And what I mean by psychologically connected, your mission statement. Are they excited about helping you, you know, be a part of that and helping you accomplish that, right? And doing that day to day. Your vision, what you're trying to build, do they get excited about that because they not only see what's possible for the company, but they see within that growth of the company what's possible for them, right? Company's growing, then there's opportunities for me to grow. So that's that psychological connection that we're looking for to the mission, vision, and values. And that's further enhanced when you start onboarding them, is creating that great experience takes that to another level. And it's simple things, Danny, like just be organized, have a structured plan. Don't shoot from the hip and wing it. You know, the old, hey, go to HR and fill out the paperwork and then you're going to go shadow this guy, or I'm going to sit you in this room and you're going to read this material and watch a bunch of videos all day, right? I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with reading and watching videos. We have them. That's a great, you know, tool to help educate people. But you don't want that to be day one sitting in a room doing that all day long, right? Mm-hmm. So create a great experience, be organized, be structured, be purposeful about how you welcome them, how you greet them. You know, if they got an office, make sure it's cleaned out, you know, the old person's stuff. I don't know about you. I started a job years ago where I showed up. The receptionist had no idea who I was, why I was supposed to be there. First off, she was looking down, playing a game or whatever for probably 5 minutes before she even looked up to say hello, and then had this big attitude like, what do you want? And so I said, I'm the new employee and, you know, I'm supposed to report. And she goes, well, nobody told me about it. I was like, okay, not my fault. You know, so kind of the opposite, right?
You know what I think about when you say that? I think about when I go to hang out with somebody else's friend group. I don't know if you, like, I'm thinking about, like, I don't know these friends, but I've got this one friend that I kind of know, and he's inviting me in to go for a boat trip with them or whatever it is. And it's like that first interaction will either make that fishing trip with those group of guys that I don't know at all the best day ever, or I'm going to be socially awkward sitting on the side of the boat fishing on my own while they all have a good time. And it's kind of like getting them into the culture and getting them into the vibe where it's like, you're a part of us now. Let's rock and roll versus, hey, we all know each other and good luck, you know, trying to fit in. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah. By the way, that's objective three that will come.
Okay. Sorry. I'm getting ahead of it.
That's right. Objective two, right? So objective one, just create an amazing onboarding experience, right? Something they don't get elsewhere. And again, it could just be lots of little things like, you know, if you got a reception area, you could get a little sign, welcome Danny to our team, right? When you first walk in, just little stuff like that. Or, you know, if they got an office, put a little gift basket or something in there. You know, just things like that go a long way to creating that psychological connection to your organization.
Is it fair to just put yourself in their shoes a little bit? Because I think all the things you're saying, I'm like, if you just put yourself in their shoes and you're like, this person doesn't know anybody and their career and their like their paycheck and everything is about to come from this. How are they think? What are they thinking about? What are they feeling? What are they going through? And using that to help dictate how you build that first amazing experience.
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
Yep. All right. All right. Objective two, help them understand the big picture. Right. So meaning, you know, we help hire carpenters. I was talking to this one carpenter one time. He said, look, he goes, been a carpenter 25 years, worked for a dozen different companies. He said, you know, my usual routine starting the company, go in, fill out the HR paperwork. I get shuffled off in the field to go do my job. Right. He goes, besides the HR person, I never met anybody inside the company, didn't know who did what. I didn't understand how the company worked other than we build X, right? So help them understand the big picture. So what we help our clients do is create a project journey. So how do we, you know, I get leads? What happens with marketing? Then what happens to hand off, you know, to the call center or to sales? How are jobs sold? And again, it's not teaching them how to do all this stuff. It's just helping them understand, look, this is what happens for them when a lead first comes in to when we complete a project and close it out, right? These are the different maybe 10 steps that we go through. So helping them understand that big picture. And then also instead of you maybe saying, you know, as their hiring manager, and this is another mistake that most companies make is they only have one person doing the training, right? Which is hard on you if you're the one having to do it all. But you also miss out on objective three. And objective three is build relationships that lead to collaboration. Mm-hmm. And the reason that those two elements are so critically important, Danny, is here in the States, I don't know if you're familiar with the Society for Human Resource Managers, SHRM.
Nope.
kind of the HR go-to association. And it's where HR people get certified, if you will, right? Anyway, it's a big organization out of Washington, D.C., been around forever. They do a lot of research as well. And year after year, over the last probably 15 years or more, their research has pointed to one of the number one factors that leads to retention are relationships with other employees. Right. And they've even got it down to the more relationships, they've tracked it to longer retention and less likely to accept an offer from outside if someone, you know, comes after them. And then collaboration, right? You're not going to collaborate unless you have a relationship and know who these people are, right? So for example, when we hire salespeople, right? First thing we do is we bring in the marketing team, let them introduce themselves, not just, hey, I'm Mike, I'm the social media manager, right? Or the event manager, but it's like, hey, I'm Mike Madalone. Let me tell you a little bit about me, right? Here's where I live. Here's what I do. I'm with my wife. I live with my kids, my dogs, you know, when I'm not working, I love doing this, but here's what my job is here. Right. And here's how I support you. Right. And then so we went through, we have all the marketing people explain, introduce themselves so they get to know them personally, as well as why they love working at your company. That's another piece we have them tell. Why do you love working here? Oh, I love working here because of this or that. And usually you're going to hear themes along the cultural line. Right. So doing that, what we found is the salespeople complaining about the shitty leads that they get. Right. We found out it pretty much goes away because they understand that we put the same amount of effort and the same money into every lead. We know some are better than others, but, you know, that you need to understand the same effort money goes into it. You know, so So that's what it is.
It humanizes the role. You're like, hey, I see this with my sales and marketing team all the time. It's a constant argument. But there's like a higher level of trust and understanding when my sales team is going to marketing being like, but I know Aaron, or I know Lauren, or I know, and they're like, and I know that that's not ill-intended. So let's just work together on it versus being argumentative or combative.
Exactly.
I want to come back to one thing you had mentioned earlier, the big picture. You kind of skated through it quick. I was thinking about what you're saying, where you're like, you want to have them kind of see the whole production line of everything that's going on. Yeah. We actually do this in our company as well. Actually, it's funny. So sitting right over there, no one can see him on camera, but is Chris, who is, anyways, he just started with us and he's here at the podcast today to see this part of how we do what we do. But this instills critical thinking, does it not? Because like, I think about these roles where it's like, I do this widget piece making thing in the production line. And if you mm-hmm. don't understand the bigger picture, you're never going to be able to think critically. And so there's so much locked inside of you that probably never actually gets used because you're just a number on a big, and this is like, smaller companies don't have this issue as much, but I watch as businesses get bigger and it's like people turn off their critical thinking brains. And I think they actually have them. I think they just don't use them because they were never trained that that was a part of the process. That was okay. Anyway, I just want to comment on that because I was like, that to me seems like the biggest
stuff. And of course, so like I said, the marketing thing I was talking about is part of that big picture. Another piece of the big picture, we send those salespeople out in the field for a day to work with the project managers and see how we actually built, right? And then again, it's the same introduction that the project manager tells about them personally, why they love working at the company. So you got to give them an introduction outline to follow and then have them explain, this is what I do to support you. And by the way, you know, we had even PMs tell a few salespeople, say, look, so, you know, rather than you going out and making a promise to a customer we can't deliver on, if you run across this situation, here's my cell phone, call me, you know, let's collaborate so that you sell something that's a win-win for all of us. And again, they don't need to understand how to do the project manager's job. They just need to understand the importance of how they're supporting
it with the whole enchilada,
how it all fits together. So that's the three is create an amazing experience, help them understand the big picture, and then build relationships that lead to collaboration. Those are the three objectives that will lead to creating a passionate, collaborative, productive company advocate.
And is it fair to say what you're talking about is kind of the context to the content mm-hmm. of skill training along the way? Is that what we're like? Because we didn't even talk about skills. So it's at some point these guys got to learn how to do their job. But this is the
that usually happens on day three or four.
Sure. And this is, and what we're setting is the context to how you will learn and engage and develop and be a part of our organization over time.
Yeah.
Okay.
And another critical piece I want to close on this subject on is the end of day check-in. Right. This is a critical piece that you got to do at the end of each of the first two or three days. So, but you tell the new employee up front, right? So, hey, look, at the end of the day, I'm going to ask you about each session that you go through. So part of being organized, right? Hey, the first session you're going to sit in is maybe with the company president who's going to go over our mission, vision, and values. And by the way, you need to learn and memorize those, you know, by X time, right? Over the next week or two. And we're going to test you on it, right? So pay attention, take notes. Then you're going to go sit down with finance and they're going to tell you how you get paid. Then you're going to go sit down with our sales manager who's going to walk you through sales, or with our marketing person, then our project manager. So when I said organized, you have a laid out schedule, right? So they know exactly what to expect over the couple of days. But then you tell them, at the end of the day, I'm going to ask you two questions. What did we do well so we can continue doing that for all other new hires? And by the way, this is important that you tell them. The reason we're asking this is we value your opinions as a new employee. Sometimes we're too close to things and we appreciate your outside perspective. By showing them that you value their opinions and you're going to ask for them on day one, right, helps to create that psychological bond and connection to your organization. The second question that I'm going to ask you is, I'd say, Danny, I want you to tell me what could have been better. And I'm not looking, and it's so important you have to tell them, I'm not looking for you to critique us and be critical, because no new employees ever going to want to do that, right? Or most, sure. Right? There's exceptions.
Depends on their core values.
Yeah, so you got to tell them. What I'm looking for is maybe that session on marketing needed more time, or it would have been better if you had some visuals, you know, or the project journey, you know, if you would have had a chart that kind of showed me how each step goes, that visual could have been helpful. So if you tell people what you're looking for, they'll step up and give it to you. So when we first started doing this program years ago, we were working with a design build firm that we had hired a project manager, an estimator, a kitchen and bath designer, and a lead carpenter. They all started the same day. They all went through this 3-day onboarding training program that I've been describing. At the end of the day, we asked them the two questions. First person to speak up was the carpenter I was talking about earlier, who said, look, I'm in my jeans. I expected to come in, fill out paperwork, and be shoveled off in the field. The fact that you kept me here all day and you showed me the next 2 days I'm going to be here with a structured schedule. I've already met so many people of your employees who have been so welcoming and friendly, who have helped me to learn what they do and how that relates to me and how my job relates to them. He goes, I already called my wife at lunch and told her I found my last job.
Wow.
Right? That's what you're striving for. And that can only be done in that first couple of days.
I got to ask Chris, he's sitting behind him, he can answer later. What did we do well and what could be done better? He's going through his onboarding with us right now. Awesome. Okay. Let's get into retain now. So walk me through, what are the elements of retention that matter? I've got culture, motivators, one-on-ones, annual reviews, career paths. Within time, what are the key things here that we need to be conscious of to have better retention in our organization?
Yeah. So go back. We'll start at the hiring process, right? Most hiring is done one-sided. What do we need, right? I need you to do this, this, and this. Can you do that, right? If you can, I'll hire you, right? But as we said, employees have a lot of choices in today's world. And if they're good candidates, they're interviewing you as much as you're interviewing them, trying to decide, is this the place I want to be?
Can I comment on that, actually? There is something I started doing along the way in my interviews where... Because when I first started interviewing, I thought I had to have a position of authority and I thought I needed to hold that while I was interviewing them. I shifted and I was like, look, here's the deal, man. Like my expectation setting at the beginning, I don't want this to be the wrong fit almost as badly as I hope you don't either, because here's what's going to happen. If I hire you within 3 to 4 months, we're going to fire you or you're going to quit. Then you're going to go back on your job search. I'm going to have to go back and find someone and we're going to disrupt each other's lives. So is it fair to say that it's in both of our best interests to find out if this is a good fit or not and try and be as objective as possible? And it's a very interesting way to start that whole conversation, because they suddenly realize, like, I don't have to prove anything to you. We're both trying to achieve the same thing. And I visually, like, in my mind, I place it as, like, if we're playing a tennis match, I'm not trying to smack the ball over to you and you're smacking it back to me and we're trying to play a game here. I'm actually bringing you over to the other side of the court, putting my arm around you and being like, can we go look at this together and see if we can figure this out or not? And it's like, I'm on the same team, basically.
Right. So Danny, tell me the reaction from those candidates after you do
relief.
That.
Relief and a genuine sense
all that
of realness
and pressure goes away.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So think of it this way. We tell, you know, our job is to hire the best person.
Mm-hmm.
What's the candidate's job?
Sometimes it's to get hired to pay the bills, but to find the best role for their career. A lot of them are just like, I just want to make sure the best ones want to make sure that they're going to have a future here that's going to serve their life, their goals, what they want to go get done.
Right. But where I was going with that, Danny, is our job is to hire the best person. Their job, in summary, is to be the best person, right? So they are trying to tell us everything they think we want to hear, right? And realistically, you know, they're a lot of times just acting. You know, being somebody that they're really not. And then you hire that person and a month or two later, you're like, what happened to that person I hire?
Totally. And Mike, this is what I'm talking about. I'm saying, like, I try to get through that early on because otherwise the interview is pointless. It's like, who can, like, cover up the truth the best and how quick can we get through this so I can make a snap decision that's probably uninformed? I'm just like, look, I kind of throw the rules out a bit and I'm just kind of like, I don't really like want to like be interviewing you and you to be trying to impress me. I need both of us to come to a common like level of just humanness. And it's like, we can talk and get through it together and see. And where it doesn't work is where people are desperate and people need a paycheck. You can usually smell that though, as you go through the process.
Yep.
The best candidates though, I find are like, thank God. And it, if anything, is like one of the biggest selling points of them even want to work with us. Like, this is one of our values. Be real. It's like, this is a genuinely real experience.
Well, we take it a little further. You tell them, say, look, I hope you're trying to make as good of a decision as we are. So I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about the company, the job. And by the way, this then goes to the final interview, right? So I always tell people, so the first half of that final interview is for you to decide, is this someone we want to bring on? Mm-hmm. And as soon as you get in your head that, yeah, I think this is a good person we want to move forward with, you switch gears completely to helping the candidate make an informed decision.
Right.
So remember I said the number one reason they leave in the first 90 days is the I don't knows. So what you're going to do now is you're going to say, hey, this is what a typical day, a typical week looks like, the tools, resources you will or won't have. If they work for me, Dana, I'd say, like, here's issues for me, right? You know, I'm a really impatient person. Sometimes I can be gruff. You know, I don't mean to be, you know, mean or bad, but I know I've been told it comes across that way. So I'm working on it, but you're going to see that. And I don't want that to be a surprise, right? A month or two down the road.
I want to pause you on that. That is so important. So you've now decided this person is going to be an awesome fit. You know what I think automatically a lot of us do? Is I got to get this person.
Start selling.
And I think the person, yep. and we're all guilty of this. And I think it's a natural, just like human thing we're going to do. But to be conscious that that is going to happen and try and fight against that. Where it's like, because I think the candidate smells that. And I think it actually turns them off. I think the right amount of candor, and the key is the right amount of candor. Because I think if you just start bleeding out all the stuff, it's like that could be wrong too. But it's like the right amount of candor. And to get real with them at that point is probably your best move. And again, the best candidates will be drawn to that more than anything.
And by the way, a lot when you do that effectively, right, a lot of times you'll have candidates will say, well, Danny, are you trying to scare me away?
Yeah.
Right? And if they ask you that, A, you know you did a good job. And then your response needs to be a canned approach. Yet, Danny, if what I'm telling you scaring you away, good. Let's figure it out today. Because what I'm trying to do, you know, I told you all the great things about our company, but we're like every organization. We have our ups or downs, our good or bad. I want you to know what those are, because if you come into this eyes wide open and know, like dealing with me, right? I said, it may be challenging, but as long as you know you got to do that and I'm working on it and I'm open to getting better, this will work out. But if I don't mention any of this and it's a surprise to you a month or two down the road, you know, the good chances are you're just going to get frustrated and quit.
Totally.
Or you're not going to produce, and then I'm going to fire that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good kind of test if they actually tell you, you know, or ask you, are you trying to scare me away?
Okay. Good. So interview process, be candid, be real, bring out the truth, and then don't hide behind it. What else? Yeah. What are some other key elements?
So you'll find your first 90-day retentions will go up from that piece.
Okay.
The onboarding training, those three objectives, right? Focus on creating passionate, collaborative, productive company advocates. Starting off with training on your mission, vision, values, your culture, right? And then the project journey, help them understand the big picture, building relationships. As I said, Sherm said, yep, this is one of the leading factors to retention is relationships. So again, while you could do all that training, you know, A, that's hard on you, but you should get as many other people as possible. The people who head up each department is who should do that training, or a delegated representative that knows it in there. So that relationship piece leads to higher retention rates. And then the caring about the people, right? Which goes to being the performance coach, not the micromanager. Like, I'm here to help you grow in your, we have a career path. We have a way for you to get to the next place. That career path is critical third piece to that retention. So when we apply this and stuff with all our clients, and over the last probably 8-9 years, we've been tracking it, we find that our first 90-day retention rates are over 95%, and our first 12-month retention rates are up over 85%. So you will see dramatically significant improvements by focusing on those three areas.
Yeah, we have a process we teach called GSNR, Goal Setting and Review, and all of our team basically goes under it. It's what we teach our members to do too, and it allows an employee to have a goal, a set of accountabilities and deliverables to go after, but then instead of just giving it to them and saying, good luck this year, it's like every week or 2 weeks where they're helping coach them to help hit their year-end goals, and we're developing them along the way. I have a wrench thrower in here I want to ask you that is not all about the rosy, perfect spreadsheet scenarios. What do you do when a high performer quits your team that the whole team looked up to? And how do you manage that? Because we have had that happen internally, and I imagine other companies do. It happens. How do you manage that process and scenario to keep the team aligned?
Yeah, so the piece that you said is really critically important to this is that, had you worded it, everyone else looks up to and respects.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of people just say high performer based on their output.
Sure. Because right? That could be a jerk, though. That could be somebody that everyone's...
Exactly, right. If you're a total jerk,
it doesn't matter,
and
get out of here.
Chaos and havoc, but you're bringing in a lot of business, right? But at what it costs,
yeah.
Right? So in those situations, it's like, wish them luck. And it's a bummer that we're going to lose that revenue. But you know what? We can find someone who's a better fit to replace it, right? So, but the caveat you said is no, but everyone respects them. They are a contributing member. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I would say is, you know, you need to be more proactive and not let those things become surprises, right? If you're in tune as a manager with your people and meeting frequently, you know, you should be doing stay interviews, you know, at least once a quarter. Hey, how are things going? You know, what's not working for you? You know, what could I do to make it better for you here? So if you're asking those right questions, at least on a quarterly basis, and you're in tune with your people, you'll know before any of that stuff happens, right? So, but if, you know, if you have that info and they're still quitting at that point, right? I mean, at that point, the only thing I could say is, you know, try to figure out the why, and is that something that you can control and turn around? And if not, you know, it's unfortunate, but at that point, it's almost too late.
I'll steer this a bit because I think this scenario that happens is, as much as we might want to as entrepreneurs think that we have the greatest company ever that provides the best opportunity for all the people until the end of time, we all can and do reach limits with certain people. And there are people that should move on. And there are people that can have bigger and better opportunities in other arenas. But it's a hard emotional thing to deal with because it's also a great producer that everybody loves. I think at some level, you just said it actually, and I'll just rephrase what I think I got from what you just said, which is to be proactive in this, is to know as an owner and have a level of maturity around this to get in front of it. And so that doesn't lead to them quitting, but it actually leads to a planned exit where it's like, I want you to move on, even though this company may not, it's not in my best interest as the entrepreneur, it is in your best interest and it is in the commitment that we made to you the day we hired you to do this right.
Exactly. And so those stay interviews are part of that, Danny. The other thing that companies should be doing is an employee engagement survey at least twice a year. You know, beginning of the year, benchmark it, and then at least once at the end of the year, sometimes three times in a year, once every 6 months. But that'll, if you're using the right employee engagement assessment, you'll get insights as to what's working, what's not working, and where you need to make adjustments to make sure you have that thriving culture that people want to be a part of.
And that's fair. As you get bigger, I've noticed that too. It's easier to not be able to know. You just don't know. You're just like, as the owner of an organization, you actually probably know the least about what happens internally every single day and where people are all at. So especially as things grow.
Right. As the owner, but that's what I'm saying. Then as a manager or performance coach, you should know your people, right? I know my people, you know your people. This person knows their people. That way we each only, and by the way, on that, you know, nobody should have more than 5 to 8 direct reports that you're interacting with on a daily basis, because it's too difficult, as you just pointed out, when you got 20, you know, people, because I hear that a lot too. How many people are you responsible? Oh, I manage 50 people. Really? How do you do that? Yeah. You don't even have time in a week to talk to 50 people. And if you're being effective as a manager, you need to be talking probably daily, at least, you know, once every other day. So, but if you can manage that, right, then you know your folks, I know my folks, and we can stay more on top of that as opposed to one person trying to figure it all out.
5 to 8, that's just a good number for people to know. 5 to 8, because I think that's, is it 2? Well, it's below. Is it 20? No, definitely not. But 5 to 8, I've heard that before. 8 is what I've heard, but 5 to 8, that's a good little like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, and it depends on the complexity of what they do and how much things change in their role, right? So I usually say, look, once you get to about 8, you know, in any role, then you need an assistant person who's kind of there to help take some of that load from you on the day to day.
Makes sense. This is awesome, Mike. This is good. So we're at time-ish. We can keep going if you want. I just want to know, like, anything else we should be touching on that we haven't hit on? Is there any other major things that I haven't hit on with you that we should be talking about?
All right. So we talked about the hiring. We talked about the onboarding, talked about retention elements. Talked about the importance of mission, vision, values in your culture. What else? I think we covered quite a bit.
Yeah, let me say this because
I could talk for hours, as you're probably aware, but
let me say this because in the spirit of all the things we did cover, which is a lot, and people are listening to a podcast, it's like there's no way they're going to do all these things. So what is probably the lowest hanging fruit, highest impact thing of everything we just talked about that someone listening right now could go take action on and actually see some pretty tangible results? Because it's like, it's obvious, it's simple, it's quick to implement. What is the one thing, do you think?
One, it's... And it probably just because this is what we just talked about, this do the stay interviews, right? With your direct report. So, and you can contact me. I'm happy to give people those questions, or go out on Google, ChatGPT, and ask what are great stay interview questions. You'll get a whole bunch of them, and then pick the ones that are appropriate for your company and department. Start doing those so you're aware of where people's heads are. That's probably a low-hanging fruit. Okay. The other one is learn about employee engagement. So, lots of books you can read, including mine. We have a whole chapter just on that, because it is the secret sauce that helps you to tap in. Oh, yeah. So this is the one we didn't talk about that I will. I mentioned earlier, discretionary effort, right? So discretionary effort. There's been tons of studies around this. Gallup, McKinsey, other huge consulting firms have done this. And they figured out that the average employee only puts in about 40 to 60% of their capacity, right? Mm. That means they got another 40 to 60% that they choose whether or not they're going to put that in. So take the owner, right? An owner puts in that effort, right? Why? Go back to what I said. And this is really what employee engagement is. It's a psychological connection to the company, your mission, vision, values. So if you're the owner, they're your mission, your vision, and your values. So hopefully you're connected to those psychologically, right? And what that means is you'll put in whatever effort it takes to help the company succeed that mission, vision, right? You live and die by those values. So that's the first part. The second part of the psychological connection to creating employee engagement is what we talked about earlier with the personality assessments. So if you know that attention to detail or being assertive or working independently or whatever those behavior, having a sense of urgency, whatever the behavioral competencies are for that role, make sure the people in that role are wired that way natural, mm-hmm. right? And again, they don't have to be a perfect fit, but close as you can get them, because then they will be intrinsically motivated by the actual work that they're doing. And then that combination with the knowledge and skill is what gets that consistently productive, but even tapping into that discretionary effort. So you're to be able to get into that other 40 to 60%, you have to focus on that psychological connection. And that's what I would say. The first thing is learn about that more, and then start, implementing tactics and strategies around that. Even just your mission, vision, values, right? It's not enough, as you know, Danny, to have them sitting on a wall somewhere, right? You've got to live them, breathe them, and day to day. So are you talking about them in your meetings? Are they on your website? Are they in your ads when you're hiring, right? Is it part of your onboarding training? That would be one of the other things too, is start implementing those things immediately into your hiring, onboarding, and day-to-day lives.
Everything we're talking about is revolving around retention, but you just said something that I'm like, oh my gosh, we need to hit on this, and thank you for stating on it, which is, sure. You're saying 40 to 60% of the productivity of my people comes down to doing these things effectively. So not only is it good for retention, this is actually like the make or break point of the lifeblood of my organization, which is my people. It's like I can drag mm-hmm. everybody across the line and be going 130% all the time, or I can unlock that discretionary effort by doing a good job of hiring, training, developing, and maintaining good culture on my team.
Yep.
Great.
Yeah. And it's even more important for smaller companies, right? Because we talked about earlier, you have limited resources. Well, these studies have proven you can literally double your productivity with your existing people without adding a single person to the team if you can tap into that discretionary effort in all your existing employees.
The reason I think this is so big is I think a lot of owners default to just doing it themselves. And so they are the discretionary effort for all those other roles that are lacking. And they get so busy doing all those other roles, they don't make any time for the things that we're talking about today. And now they've created their own reality in perpetuity. And what you're saying is like, unlock some of this, at least get into it, and then start to free yourself up. So it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You'll have more space and time to continue to do these things in a much more effective manner with your team.
Yep. And what you just said there, Danny, what you described is most entrepreneurs build themselves a job.
Yeah.
Right. I'm doing everything. I'm working 60, 70 hours a week. Right. Even if I'm making more money than when I did when I worked for someone else, I don't have any time to enjoy it because I'm working 60, 70 hours a week. Mm. Right. And to build a company, you have to focus on the team, because the capacity of your company is dictated by the capacity of your team, what they're capable of doing. Because there's only so many hours in the day that any one of us can do things. So, but a high performing team, as you know, the possibilities are endless.
I have tried to work all the hours for all the team. It doesn't work. I got broken. Danny got broken. Mike, that was great. Let's make sure people can reach out to you if they want to connect with you, they want to find you.
Yep.
Where do we get in touch with you, man?
So one, our website, xp3talent.com, and that's the number 3, like here. My email, if you want to email me directly, is mike@xp3talent.com. So those would be the 2 ways. And then obviously, you know, if they're interested to go out to Amazon, get a copy of the book, that's another way you can learn all about everything we talked about in much more detail.
Do you have an employee agreement, some sort of assessment or anything that we could put on a link and just people could use?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So on our website, there's actually 2. We have a free employee engagement survey. Yeah. So that's where you ask. You can go there and do that for free. The other tool we have on our website that people will find interesting is what we call a company diagnostic. And it helps you to assess the 5 pillars of your business, which is people, leadership, operations, production, sales, marketing, and finance. And there's about 12 topics in there that you rank on a 10-point scale. And the way this should be done is the management team should get together and do this. And then it's just, so example, like under people, will say, how good are we at hiring top talent? Do we have a structured, objective process, right? And then by, you know, do we have all the right people in the right roles? You know, do people understand what their role is and our clarity on how success is defined? So there's questions like that under these statements that you rank, and that helps you to pinpoint where you're doing well as an organization and where you might have gaps that you need to start focusing and figure out what is that priority, what's the low-hanging fruit that we can work on over the next 90 days to start making traction.
Awesome, Mike.
So those are 2 free tools on the website that people can get to try out.
Go talk to Mike. Go unlock the discretionary effort. Boom. I don't know what else to say. That's amazing. I learned a lot. Thank you for that. And thank you for your time, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. It's been great.
Okay. Have a good one.
All right. Bye now.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.